My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. After a moment of silence, I'd like to start with a prayer. My Creator, help me to set aside everything I think I know about you, everything I think I know about myself, everything I think I know about my fellows, and everything I think I know about my own recovery, all for a new experience in you, Lord, a new experience in myself, a new experience in my fellows, and a much-needed new experience in my own recovery. Amen. My name is Bob Darrell, and I am an alcoholic. Through the grace and power of a God I did not believe in, I haven't had a drink or any mind or emotion-altering substances since October 31st, 1978. And for that, I owe you my life. I'm sober today only through the grace of God. And you'll hear speakers in Alcoholics Anonymous say that a lot. And yet, alcoholics die every day begging God for help. I bet you that there are people in this room that have been saved, had religious experiences, and then drank again after that. I've had the occasion over the last a little over 27 years to sponsor 4 members of clergy. 2 of them drank themselves to death, weeping because they couldn't connect with a God that they knew was there and couldn't access the power. There was never a question of, that they believed. They always believed. They devoted their life to God. They prayed and read the Bible more in 1 week than most of us will do in a year. And they died of alcoholism. On the chapter, We Agnostics, it makes a statement in here. It says, lack of power. That was our dilemma. Not lack of faith. It's not lack of religion. Lack of power. The power to transform my experience on this planet to one where I am integrated and a part of, rather than separate and apart from. The power to come out and play. The power to be a part of. The power to, as Bill talks about, or as it's talked about in the 12x12, to act extemporaneously. That means to be here rather than here. And isn't that really what I drank alcohol for? Alcohol was power. Alcohol could take a guy like me who doesn't fit anywhere, who's locked up in his head, dying of loneliness, and 4 or 5 drinks would give me the power to be extemporaneous, to be out here with you, present right now, instead of up here alone and dying. That's power. And it had a lot of other aspects of the power that I found in alcohol. In a sense, alcohol was cheap grace for the malady of my spirit. Alcohol and combinations of drugs and alcohol was a treatment, and a very immediate and effective treatment for the real malady of alcoholism. The book calls it a spiritual malady. It's the malady of my being. And it was very, very effective. And then when the disease progressed into the nether regions of alcoholism, to the place where we all end up coming here, where we can't access, the power is gone. It becomes more and more elusive. I drink, I take drugs, I do everything I can possibly do, desperately, futilely trying to jumpstart that effect and get back to the good old days, and I can't get back to them. Because if I could, I'd have never come here. Right. I'd have been out there having fun. You know what I'm saying? I would have never come here except that lack of power was my dilemma. Lack of power. And the book goes on to say, well, we had to find a power by which we could live because the other one dried up. We had to find a power by which we could live, and it had to be a power greater than ourselves, obviously. Now, that's not obvious to all of us, but you try to fix yourself long enough, and it's obvious. Because out of our own failure comes the epiphany of I'm screwed here. I can't fix myself. I can't change myself. There's nothing I've been able to do. There's no medications. There's no church. There's no new relationship. There's no amount of money. There's nothing I can do to change my experience sober so that I can be comfortable enough sober to stay sober. Because my experience without the power in sobriety is that it feels like I'm doing time. And I put up with it for a while. But eventually I can't really fix myself. I can do it temporarily. It says, well, that's exactly what this book is about. Its main object is to enable you to find a power greater than yourself, which will solve your problem. I've often wondered about these two guys that I sponsored that were clergy, drank themselves to death. And I remember when Frank had called me when he'd started his last run, and he was drinking and he was weepy. You know that way you get and you drink and you're sobbing and you're feeling sorry for yourself and God doesn't love me and I don't know what's wrong and I pray and I ask him and when I finally got the news that he had died, I was amazed. I was shocked because I knew at that moment in my life something that I know just as much today, that I was sober only through God's grace. And the reason I was shocked is if that's true, I mean, wouldn't you think a man of the cloth would have a leg up on the rest of us? I mean, wouldn't you? I mean, he's a priest, for God's sakes, and he dies of alcoholism? I'm a bum, and I'm sober. I mean, it doesn't make sense to me. But see, the problem wasn't his lack of faith. It was his lack of power. If I were to bring you to where I live in Las Vegas, which is out in the middle of the desert, and I were to bring you there in August, and I could take you in my car outside of town to a place called Lake Mead. It's one of the largest bodies of fresh water in the western United States. And I could show you Lake Mead, and then I could drive out into the desert in the middle of nowhere. I've shown you Lake Mead and give you a map of where I'm going to let you off in the desert, and the map showing you how to get to Lake Mead. In the desert in August in Las Vegas, it can be over 115 degrees. And I will let you out of that car. And if you do not follow the directions on that map, you can wander around the desert and die of thirst, knowing, because you saw it, knowing the water's there. But if you can't find a way to get to the water and access the water, the knowledge and the faith that the water's there does not help you. You must access the power. And that is the dilemma that guys like me face. Couple years before I got sober, I was in a county jail cell, and I woke up there, and I don't remember being arrested, and it was horrible. It was not a new experience for me. I used to get arrested in blackouts sometimes, and I'd wake up in jail, and it's always a bad thing. And this time I have an extremely bad feeling about the whole thing, and I don't know why I'm there. And they take me into a room, and there's a detective there who's telling me that I'm there because the only friend I have left in the world, the only guy that would still have anything to do with me, that the night before I took a knife with a blade this long and I'd opened up his chest and he was in the hospital in the intensive care ward and he was dying. And as the detective is telling me that, I'm looking down at my blue jeans and they are purple with his blood. And I remember sitting there and I feel like I am going to start screaming. And if I start, I will never stop. That I will be in one of those I love me jackets in some hospital for the rest of my life. But what I did is I pushed the feelings down, got hard inside, pushed those feelings down and put on my game face. But they took me back to my jail cell after the interview and I fell apart. And on my knees on a hard floor in a county jail, I begged a God that I felt so estranged from. I begged him not to ever let me drink that stuff again. I got drunk the day I got out. If you have a few of those experiences, it's and then you come into Alcoholics Anonymous and these happy-go-lucky people say, oh, and I'm just sober by the grace of God. It's not good news for me, right? That's good news for you. But see, I'm convinced by this point, by 1978, after 7 years of institutions since I was a kid, 7 years of failure, I'm absolutely convinced that if there is a God, and if that is the answer, that I secretly within myself believe that that answer is not available to me. That I am too bad, I have gone too far, I'm too broken, I'm too sick, I'm too something. But I am absolutely convinced that my case is different. That power may work for 4 million members of Alcoholics Anonymous, but I am convinced that my case is different. I'm absolutely convinced of it. And on page 46, there's a very simple paragraph. And it talks about what is necessary to begin to access the power. Not to access the power, but to at least to start going in that direction towards it. And it says, I got to do two things. It says, the first thing, it says, we found that as soon as we were able to lay aside prejudice. Well, what's prejudice? It comes from the Latin, it means to prejudgments. It's all my opinions, my preconceived notions. The problem with that is my prejudices, I don't understand or see that they're prejudices. Those are just things that's just the way it is. All right? I don't get that it's a judgment. It's just that way. And it's sometimes my prejudices are emotional, and they're right below the horizon within me. And I'm not conscious of them, but yet they drive me and affect my whole view of life, as they are what they talk about in chapter 5 is our old ideas, the things that I just think are so. And I can't lay aside my prejudices because I think they're right. And Father Frank and the other guy who eventually died of alcoholism, I think one of the reasons that they couldn't get this thing is that they were secretly convinced that their judgments and perception and opinions of God were the right kind. And they couldn't let them go. And it doesn't say we throw them away. It says we lay them aside. Because maybe later we find out that some of them are right. But for right now, the important thing to lay them aside is that to be surrendered is to be childlike. An opinion less. And the more ideas I got, the old ideas and the prejudices and opinions about God that I bring to the table, the more baggage I have between me and God. And I am absolutely incapable of being humble enough to be childlike in my approach as if I know nothing. The Buddhists have an old story about the wisdom of knowing the most important thing you would ever know. And it's a story of an old Chinese farmer who lives on this little meager farm that he doesn't even own the farm. The land is owned by a lord, and he grows crops, and he has to tithe and surrender a portion of his bounty and his crops to this lord for the privilege of working the fields. And he owns only one thing in his whole world, one possession, and that's a horse. And he lives there with his only son, and they work the fields, and it's a hard life. And one day, the horse, his only possession, runs off. And his friends and family and neighbors come over to console him, to tell him how terrible this is, that he's lost his whole estate. This is awful. And the little old Chinese man just shrugs his shoulders and says, "I don't know if it's awful. Maybe it is. Maybe it isn't." And they look at him like he's crazy. A couple days later, the horse returns, and it's leading a whole herd of wild horses right into his corral. Now he's the richest man in the valley, and his friends and neighbors come over to congratulate him. "This is great. This is good." And the little old man says, "I don't know if it's good. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't." And they look at him like, "What are you smoking? I mean, you know, right? I mean, you hit the goddamn lottery, for Christ's sakes. You know, it's good." And he just keeps going, "I don't know if it's good." A couple days later, his son is trying to break in one of the wild horses. And he's thrown, and he's crippled, and he can't walk, and he can't work, and they immediately rush over to console him, to tell him how bad this is. And he says, "I don't know if it's bad. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't." And they think, "My God, that's your only son. How cold. You can't see that this is bad." And he just kept saying, "I don't know if it's bad. Maybe it is, and maybe it isn't." And in a week or so later, the Chinese army, under a warlord, came through the valley, and they forced all the young men to go and fight in a battle where none of them would survive, and they couldn't take the son because of his leg. And he was able to live. And see, the old man knew the most important thing that he would ever know is that he doesn't know. And the most important thing I will ever know is that I don't know. We talk in Alcoholics Anonymous about this surrender process. And to be surrendered is to be opinionless. Because what am I surrendering, really? I'm surrendering my judgment about my life. I had a lot of prejudices about my childhood religion. And I grew up, I suspect, in a very similar religious background to a lot of you guys, with a lot of Christianity and the Bible and all that kind of thing. And I had shut the door on most of that, and I found fault with it. And then after my spiritual experience or awakening through the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, a funny thing happened. I was able to go back and revisit some of those things from my childhood, but I looked at them now through different eyes. I looked at them through the awakening that was within me. And what I started looking at the story of creation in Genesis, and it's the story of Adam and Eve. And it's an amazing story, really, when I look at it through the eyes that I have today. Here's Adam and Eve. God made Adam and Eve, and he put them in heaven on earth, the Garden of Eden, which was like literally a paradise on earth. Perfect paradise. Heaven on earth. He told him, "This is yours. You can do anything you want. Have a good time. Live it up. Have fun." We suggest that you don't eat the fruit of this one tree. Don't eat. It's probably a good idea if you don't do that. And what's the tree? It's the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And they were great. It was heaven on earth. It was wonderful. And I think one day they ate that fruit and got the knowledge of good and evil, got the discernment, got the judgment, got the aspect of trying to play God from the throne of judgment. And all of a sudden, Adam's going, "And I thought this was nice, but it's crap. God, there's crabgrass. God, leaves got cellulite, for Christ's sakes. I mean, what were you thinking?" And what had been heaven immediately became awful. And what had changed? Nothing except the judgment. Right? One of my spiritual mentors was a guy named Chuck Chamberlain. And Chuck used to tell a story about sitting in his house in Southern California in this chair that he had that he always sat in. And he said he'd just come off a bad drunk, and he was having problems in every area of his life. And he sat in this chair. He was married to this woman, and he worked at a certain place, and he lived in this house, and he felt like he was in hell. And it was awful. And years later, he sat in the same chair in the same house, working at the same place, married to the same woman. And he felt like he had tears in his eyes because he felt like he was in heaven. And he said he realized that heaven's just a new pair of glasses. What had changed except his perception and judgment of what was going on? And that really is what I have to undo and get rid of, uncover, discover, and discard in this journey to remove the separation between me and God. And it starts with laying aside my prejudices. And with a lot of the guys I sponsor, I encourage them. We sit and I'll have them either write down a list of their prejudices or else we'll talk about it. What are the things within you? What are the ideas, the feelings, the sense within you that will make it very hard for you to approach God on a day where you've just did something that you hate yourself for? It's good. It's able. It's really easy to pro. What about the day? Do you have a God that will be there for you when you beat your kids sober? Do you have a God that'll be there for you when you've just done some sexual stuff that, God, you just wish you'd have never done? Do you have a God that'll be there for you when you've done some things with money that you're ashamed of, that you want to keep secret? Or do you have a God that's only there for you when you're good? Because if you have a God that's only there for you when you're good, you are in a lot of trouble. Because when you need him the most, he becomes the most inaccessible. Right? So what are your prejudices? What are your old ideas? And then the second thing it says to do is, and it says, and express even a willingness to believe in a power greater than ourselves. And I didn't know the wisdom of the old timers in AA and what they're in their direction for me when I was new until many years later, and I read this in the book. And when I was new, they told me to get physically down on my knees every single morning and ask whatever was running the universe for help to stay sober for that day, and then to physically get down on my knees that night and thank whatever that was, and know that I didn't do it, and know that that was something other than me. And I didn't want to do it. I don't believe in God. I felt hypocrite. I told this guy, I said, I did it one day, and I went to him. I said, I don't want to do this. I feel like a hypocrite. He says, "What?" He says, "You've been a hypocrite all your life. What's the difference? Just do it." And he was right. I'd been the guy that I'd say one thing and do something else. I'll say, "I'll meet you at 8 o'clock. And if 8 o'clock came, if I don't feel like it, I didn't go. I was a hypocrite. I had no integrity, no oneness of person." And he said, "Just do it." And I started doing it. I lived in this halfway house. I lived in a room with three other guys in bunk beds. And I would get up in the morning and I'd go into the bathroom and I'd lock the door. And I'd make sure the drapes over the window were closed. And then I'd take the throw rug and I'd push it up under the crack underneath the door so nobody can look under there and see me pray. You know, and I'd get down on my knees. It was embarrassing. I felt funny about it. But I just did it. I did it not because I believed it would work. I did it because I believed in my own hopelessness. And I was desperate. And I would have done anything you told me to do. Because I had, and you know where that comes from? Relapse for 7 years and fail and try to commit suicide and fail. And you eventually get to a point where you'll do anything. You'll do stupid things just in a hope that you will get better. Just the hope that something will change. And I was doing this, and from the moment I started praying and in turning my consciousness towards something that I really didn't even believe in, really, some funny things started happening to me. And there's a line in the big book that says, God does not make hard terms with those who seek him. And I did it. I'm telling you, if my approach to God was measured on honesty or belief or faith, I would have scored probably zero. But I did it anyway, because all I had was the willingness. And I found out later that that physically getting down on my knees is it really a fantastic demonstration of a willingness. It's not a demonstration of faith. I didn't have that yet. And it wasn't even near a demonstration of some kind of trust, but it was a demonstration of a willingness. And I started experiencing these coincidences in my life as a result of those actions. And it was the only thing that was different, really, that and going to meetings. And the coincidences were all in my favor. They were all good. It was like I was becoming like lucky. And weird things would happen to me. Like I would have a problem. And I don't feel good. And my mind's crazy. And I don't know what's wrong with me. And I would ask this power I don't really believe in for help. And I would go to some meeting and there'd be a stranger in the meeting talking about exactly what's going on with me. And he's got not only he's telling and he's talking about it in a way where I'm able to connect the dots in me, where I'm able to sit there and go, oh yeah, that's exactly what's going on. That's what I'm doing. And he's got the answer. And now I know what to do. I got to go back to work and I got to make amends to my boss. And it becomes very clear. And this kind of experience didn't happen to me once or twice. It happened to me over and over and over. And even the skeptic that I am started to come to believe as a result of my actions. There came a point where I could not deny the overwhelming evidence in my life, in my reality, that there was the hand of something was there. Over in, I just came from London, and over in London, actually there's still parts of London that are like this, but all of London, years ago, the streets were lit with gas streetlights, gas lamps. And you could go out at twilight when the sun's starting to go down, and you could climb up to the top of the highest building in London and look out over the city. And no matter, there was a guy that would go around the streets of London and light the gas lamps with a long pole with a flame on the end. He was called a lamplighter. And you could climb up to the top of this high building and look out over the city at twilight. And no matter how hard you looked, you could not see where the lamplighter was. But you could always see where he'd been. And I could sit in a meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous at 2 years sober, and I could not see where God was, but I could see where he'd been. And even more distinctly than seeing where he'd been in my life, and it's, I could see clearly where he'd been in yours. Especially the guys that got sober 3, 4, 5, 6 months after me, because I watched them in detox. I watched them in the halfway house. I watched them coming to their first meetings. I watched the fear and the deadness in the eyes. I saw the hopelessness. I knew that they had a life that was unredeemable. I knew that they'd never, restraining orders and the things that had happened to them through the courts, I knew they would never see their kids again. I knew that they had damaged themselves to such a point that they would never really have any self-respect. And then 2 years later, I'm seeing them in the back of a meeting and they got their kids with them. And their kids are looking at them like, that's my hero. Or I'm seeing them with their first couple sponsees, and they're laughing, and they're picking on them the way that we picked on them. right? And they got the lights in the eyes. And they're joking around. And you know that they have claimed something here. You know that they have come into their inheritance. And you can't get from where they were to where they are. You can't get there. There's no medicine. There's no therapy. There's nothing. It would take a miracle. And you sit in Alcoholics Anonymous and you stay in the trenches here, and it's to stay on the front lines of a continuous transformation, a miracle. And I started coming to believe, and I could do that by watching you easier than I could watching me. It's hard to see the hand of God in your own life because God is very slow because he's old. I mean, he's very old. And to watch God work in your life is like trying to stand in front of a mirror and watch your hair grow. I mean, it's not that it's not growing. It's just a very slow thing. But I could see it in you clearly. And I started to come to believe in the only way a guy like me could. But the coming to believe in and of itself is not the solution, because faith is not the answer. My problem is power, a lack of power. You know, the guy who's noted, often referred to as the founder of modern psychology, is a guy named William James. And William James wrote a book that influenced Bill Wilson greatly. Matter of fact, right after Bill had had his conversion, Bill had went through the old Oxford group sketch or version of the steps, which is really what we have. He did it in Towns Hospital. After Bill went through the steps and he'd had his conversion experience, he was given a copy of William James's book, The Varieties of Religious Experience. And I suspect that Bill found in that book the same thing I found. I read that book twice in my sobriety. The first time I read it, I couldn't get very much out of it because it's written in a very difficult language for a guy like me. The second time I read it several years ago, I started to connect with it. And here's what I found in William James's Variety of Religious Experience. William James, from a scientific, from an academic point of view, he wanted to analyze people who had had conversion, spiritual surrender, born-again style experiences. And these experiences have been going on for thousands of years. People who were dying. Carl Jung referred to it when he was talking to Roland Hazard, that once in a while, occasionally, there's these phenomena that occur. And he wanted to study these phenomena from an academic point of view. And he realized as he started to chronicle these experiences that they invariably had two things in common. The first thing that they had in common is you never had an experience like that when your life was really good. Never. You just didn't get back from Las Vegas where you won $1 million and you married a showgirl and you're going to find God. I mean, it's just not like that. It's never like that. You're at the low spot of your life. You're demoralized, you're hopeless, you're desperate, and you hate yourself. You hate what you become. There's nothing good going on. It's a bad spot. That's the first thing they have in common. And the second thing that they had in common is that those experiences invariably are transitory experiences, which means they don't last. The shine of them eventually wears off for most people. There's a few exceptions. And most people, the old person that they were eventually reasserts itself. And the old ego grows back. And the ego, Dr. Harry Thiebaud, in AA Comes of Age, talks about the amazing recuperative powers of the alcoholic ego. You can be absolutely surrendered 1 week, and 3 weeks later, you know what's wrong with everybody. You know, it just grows back like a bad tumor. You know, it just comes back. And I believe that out of that, Bill Wilson got the motivation, that coupled with his spiritual experience and what he observed in the varieties of religious experience, he got the motivation to throw himself into two things, into trying to find a spiritual community, which he found in the Oxford group temporarily until he could 12-step enough people to start AA, and then also to throw himself in trying to transmit to someone else this shaky thing that he'd found, this slim, shaky reed that connected him to this power. And so he threw himself obsessively at trying to help other drunks. And I believe if Bill Wilson would have just done one, if he'd have done either one of those things but not both, we wouldn't be here. If he would have just settled in with the Oxford group to study and enhance his spiritual life and did not throw himself into helping other alcoholics, we would all be dead. Or if not dead, we'd be sitting somewhere wishing we were. So what is the problem that guys like me encounter? Why is it that people like my friend Tim, with 31 and a half years, takes a pistol a couple years ago and puts it to his head and kills himself? Or my friend Frank, with 23 and a half years, puts a plastic bag over his head with a rubber band and takes his own life? Or my friend Bright Eyes, who was a great gal, she put a pistol to her head at 17 and a half years of sobriety? Or the countless people who drink again. What is it that gets us back to that point of desolation? Why can't this newfound flush of spiritualism that we encounter in AA sustain a guy like me? Why can't the fellowship sustain a guy like me? On page 55, it talks about a little bit of the riddle. It starts to solve a little bit of the riddle. And this is what I've discovered, was not only true when I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous and I'm in the desolation and separation from me and you and me and God, but it is also recurringly true at times in my sobriety, in my 11th year of sobriety, when I'm disconnected again and I'm wrapped up in myself, and in my 15th year and my 19th year, that this is really what the problem is. It's the lack of power. But how, where, and when do I access that power or re-access it? And on page 55, the book talks exactly about that. It is an unbelievable prediction of exactly what will happen to me as a result of cleaning house, as a result of removing the things between me and God. On page 55, it says, actually, we are fooling ourselves, for deep down in every man, woman, and child is the fundamental idea of God. Deep down within me? Nah. My old prejudices tell me that can't be so. How could something so good and so powerful be inside something so weak and so pathetic and so bad? It doesn't make sense to me. Deep down in here? No, it must be out here somewhere. It can't be in here. Because if that's true, I can't. There's no evidence that that's true to me. Because I don't know about you guys, but when I was new, did you ever try to meditate when you're new? Oh, you might as well just don't be around any guns. I mean, it's not good. I mean, because what happens, I try to get quiet. When it gets quiet out here, it gets noisy in here. It's bad. I mean, what's he mean? What's this meditation mean? What do you think anyway? I don't know. It's like having the mind of a chronic alcoholic blocked in a state of separation from God is like being confined in a small room with an ADD hyperactive kid that just ate a lot of sugar. I mean, he just, it's crazy. Deep down within me? But here's the deal. It is there. But it says it may be obscured, which means it might be blocked off by three things. By calamity. We all know calamity. You want to know what calamity is? Imagine that on a bad day, when you're full of fear, that a doctor could surgically implant a microphone into your brain hooked up to some speakers and we could hear what you think, we would hear calamity. We are producers of calamity. The books calls us producers of confusion rather than harmony. I think there's something in every alcoholic that drives us, this malady of the spirit, to want to be out on the edge, juggling stuff, just out right there on the edge. Producers of confusion, calamity. I'm blocked by calamity. God, if God really was in me, I mean, even with a megaphone, I wouldn't hear him over the chatter in my head, right? Calamity. Second thing, pomp. Pomp's a good word for ego. That I get so full of myself and my perception and my opinions and my judgments of life that there's no room, like a glass of water filled to the top. There's no room for anything else. When it says in the big book that selfishness, self-centeredness, that we think is the root of our troubles, isn't my focus really first and foremost above and beyond alcohol, drugs, sex? Isn't it really the great obsession of my focus is myself and my security, my feelings, my well-being, me, 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 me. And it's the pomp of being the center of the universe, of being the great I am, that keeps me separate from God. Because you can't connect with God and play God at the same time. They're mutually exclusive positions. And then the third thing, worship of other things. Now, this I could not see for a long time. You could have put me on a lie detector in early sobriety and said to me, well, now that you're sober, Bob, do you worship anything? I'd have said, no, absolutely not. And the lie detector would have said I was telling the truth. But I could not see what I could not see. And I'll tell you what happened to me. I was ending my first sober relationship. It was a little over a year, year and a half sober probably. And I don't think there's a person on earth more self-obsessed than an alcoholic ending a relationship. I mean, you can go up to a guy like that and say, you know, I just came from the doctor. I have terminal cancer and 3 weeks to live. And he'll go, you know what else she said, man? You know, I just... Because it just gets on you. It just gets on you. You can't get it off of you. And I'm like that. And it's bad. And I'm dying like that. And I go to meetings. But when you're like that, you can't hear anything in a meeting. I mean, first of all, I went to this meeting, late night meeting. The girl I broke up with is in AA, which makes it worse. And she's not in the meeting, which means that some force has put a spring in the back of my neck. And every time the door to the meeting hall opens up, my head goes like this. I tell you, it's hard to hear any. If God's trying to talk to you through the people in the meeting, you can't hear nothing. You're blocked. I mean, because I'm in my head. I'm thinking about what I should say to her. I'll say this. And then she'll say that. And then I'll say this. And then she'll say that. And then I'll say this. And it'll humble her and she'll realize how wrong she was. She'll be properly ashamed of herself and beg for me to come back. You know, And while the meeting is going on, God's probably trying to talk to me through the people in AA, and I can't get this off of me, right? So the meeting is over. I have heard nothing in the meeting. I probably feel worse. And I end up going out to coffee with some people in AA, and I end up sitting in this coffee shop with one other person, a visitor from California who was sober 28 years. And after everybody else left who were tired of hearing me talk about the relationship, I had this guy, an audience alone, and I started telling him about this relationship for 20 or 30 minutes until his eyes have glazed over from listening to me ramble on about it. When I'm done, the guy listened very patiently to me. And when I was done, he said some things to me that just rocked my world. He said to me, kid, have you ever thought about the first commandment? And I said, nah, I'm not really into that. He laughed. He says, yeah, I know. He says, you and I are a lot alike. He says, guys like us, we can't get past the thou shalt not. He says, I believe the Ten Commandments were originally written as statements of spiritual cause and effect. That somehow, as they were translated out of the Aramaic and the Latin and different languages, they got a little authoritarian spin put on them. He said, but I don't think it's like that at all. He said, the first commandment is, I am the Lord thy God. Thou shalt not put false gods before me. He says, I don't think God cares, really. He said, I think he'll love you no matter what. I think you can put whatever you want between you and God. It's absolutely all right with him. The problem is you just put something between you and God. You've just blocked the light. And you will, and your being will live in the darkness of that. And when he said that, I knew what he was talking about because I felt that. I felt desolate. And he said, when you worship something else, he said, worship doesn't mean to bow down to. Worship means to obsessively turn your consciousness towards. He said, want to know what you worship? Make a pie graph of everything you've been thinking about. And the thing that owns the pie is what you have been obsessively turning your consciousness towards. And when he said that, I could picture this pie graph with a little sliver for AA, a little sliver for work, the rest of the pie was her. And no wonder I was so desolate, because I had put something between me and God, and I had put something between me and you also. Because my friends it gets to the point when you're like that, where they don't even want to hear from you in the meetings. Don't call on him. He'll whine about that thing. You know, you're separate. And I was lost. So I'm obscured. I'm cut off from God by calamity, by pomp, by worship, other things. And oddly enough, in the fourth step, as it's set up in the big book, it's set up to uncover, discover, and discard precisely those three things in different forms. As I dismantle the judgment machine that is behind the pomp in my resentment list, my hit list of the people I've built the cases against, as I dismantle that, as what Calvin talked about on page 66 and 67, and as I move away from my old ideas and my fears, from my self-reliance into God-reliance, and as I look at the sex behavior that puts me in a state of separation between me and other people, and consequently between me and God, because you can't be close to God and separate from people. It doesn't work that. I wanted it to be that way. I thought, me and God are good and the rest of you are assholes. But it don't work that way. I mean, if I'm uncomfortable around you, God becomes less accessible to me. I can always measure my distance from God by measuring my distance from you. There was a great member of Alcoholics Anonymous named Don Wood who died with a lot of years of sobriety a few years ago. And he said something in a meeting on step 10 that was so profound and yet so simple. People in the meeting were sharing about how they'd write their 10th step, or they did page 86, or they did this, or they did that. And Don said, he said, all of that's great. He said, but what I only really need to do to take my inventory is I just have to look around me. And if I see a lot of people that are just like me, struggling with a lot of the fears and insecurities and judgments and difficulties that I struggle with, but I see myself in them and I see a lot of people just like me, I'm in good shape. My spirit is connected, I'm part of. But if I look around me and I see a lot of idiots that aren't doing it right, I see a lot of self-centered, pompous people, I am in a lot of trouble. Because you were always a reflection of my spiritual condition, what I see in you. And now I tell you, I heard that a lot of years ago, and that has been uninterruptedly true in my life with a consistency. I can look around me, and if I see problems and I have conflicts and judgments and separation between me and you, I got it between me and me and me and God. Inevitably. So for faith in a power greater than ourselves and miraculous demonstrations of that power in human lives were facts as old as man himself. We finally saw that faith in some kind of God was a part of our makeup, just as much as the feeling we have for a friend. So it's saying that it's deep down within me. And then it says, sometimes we had to search fearlessly, but he was there. There's only one other place I know of where it uses those two words together. And step four, made a searching and fearless inventory of ourselves. And isn't it odd that Alcoholics Anonymous does not promise you a nearness to your Creator as a result of step three? That promise doesn't come until after step five on page 75. If you look at the history of how some of the spiritual principles of Alcoholics Anonymous have come to us, a lot of them came from a guy named Frank Buckman. And Frank Buckman was the founder of the Oxford Group. And Frank Buckman had a lot of the problems. I think Frank Buckman had a malady of his spirit. He just didn't have alcoholism. Alcohol didn't help him. But he went over to England, and he was pretty. He wanted to be a preacher. He wanted to serve God. He wanted to be useful. As a matter of fact, the bedevilments on page 52 would be a pretty good description of Frank Buckman when he was over there. He felt he was disappointed. He was disillusioned. He didn't know how to be a good minister. He didn't know how to serve God. He didn't know how to help people. And he went to hear a woman testify at the Salvation Army on this downtown, the streets of London. And he went there and he heard this woman talk about things that blew his mind. She was talking about exactly what was going on with him. The disconnection from God, the disconnection from people, the feeling, the sense of uselessness because he's not of real help to other people. And she said something he'd never heard before. She said that when you're disconnected from God and you're disconnected from other people, the answer is not to read more spiritual literature or pray more. The answer is to get rid of the things that are blocking you between you and God, such as the resentments, the fears, the sexual conduct, the things within me that keep me in the driver's seat, that keep me defending my position, that keep me wanting to be right, that keep me feeding and enhancing the ego, the part of me that plays God by getting on the throne of judgment. So it's a matter of a fearless and searching within myself to get rid of the things that are blocking me, that are obscuring me from this power. And it says that he was as much a fact as we were. We found the great reality deep down within us. What a tremendous word for God. The great reality. I think that is right on the money. I always thought God was some sort of mystical, vague, unreachable, inaccessible power source in the universe. That the idea that it might be the great reality. The idea, and it talks in chapter 5, it tells you exactly where you'll find God. Matter of fact, it's the only place you'll find God. It says, there is one who has all power, that one is God. May you find him in a place that most of us seldom visit. Now, even as I'm saying that, some of you aren't even here. You're here in your head thinking, what page was that on? Who can I tell that to? I mean, you know, now, right? Now, right here, right now, right now. I'm a thinker. Alcoholics are thinkers. We are self-centered people. No wonder we don't fit out here. The reality is I ain't out here. I'm up here. But to actually be present in the great reality. And isn't that what happened when alcohol really worked? There was a time in my life where I could walk into a bar, living in my head, worrying over the things I'd done and anguishing over a future that seemed bleak, locked up and disconnected from the presence, from right now. And I could have 4 or 5 drinks and I could show up in my life. I could be present. I could talk to people. I could listen to them. I could honestly care about them. I had a sense of immediate present intimacy with people. And if, as the book says, in a feeling that life was good. When I lost that, I was a desolate guy. Desolate. That I will find the great reality deep down within me. And it says that it's only in the last analysis, it is only that there that he may be found. Only in the last analysis I'll find him, in the last place I'll ever look, deep down within me. I don't know why it's the last place we look, but it's always the last place. I guess it's for the same reason that you find your car keys in the last place you look. Because once you find it, you don't got to look no more. But it's always in the last place. But we always look everywhere else first. I did that with AA. I looked. I went to some great psychiatrists. I took medications. I went to churches. I went to self-help groups. I went to group therapy. I primal screamed. I went to meditation seminars. I was everything from Ram Dass to Rum Dum by the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous. I tried everything I could try. And intermittently, throughout me trying everything I can to fix me, there's something happening and I don't connect the dots. And what's happening is I keep ending up in AA over and over and over. Well, it's not that. It's got to be over here. I keep ending up in AA. Well, it's got to be over there. No, and I keep ending up in AA. And I'm not getting it. It's like, I don't want to come here. I don't want to come here. I want to go anywhere. I would rather be a mental health patient than an alcoholic in AA. I'd rather be anything than one of you. In the last analysis, I finally came to you. And in the fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous, it was only in the last analysis that I start taking the journey within by uncovering, discovering, and discarding the things within me that had been blocking me. You see, my first 4.5 years of sobriety, it was a rough, hard, frantic, desperate sobriety. I went to 15 meetings a week. I was involved in every type of service there was available, as if I could outrun my alcoholism by frantic, desperate action. But Chuck used to say, there eventually comes a time when you can no longer put anything between you and you. And eventually you get to the end of that string where all the activity in the world does not really change what's in here. And it was time for me to come back and do the work. And thank God, in this synchronistic universe I live in, by the time I got to that place, as the Buddhists say, when the student's ready, the teachers will appear. By the time I got to that place, the teachers had already appeared. And I was able to go through the process in the big book and uncover, discover, and discard the stuff that was blocking me from this power source. And from you. Because I was very blocked from you. I was like Calvin, the judgmental guy. And that still is my bane today. That is why I have a 10th step. Because I must continue to clear away the things that separate me from you and ultimately from God. Continue. In the last analysis, it was after I looked everywhere else in sobriety. I looked for power. I looked for power by being a GSR, by being a DCM, by being the convention chairman, by seeing how many people I could sponsor, by seeing how good I could sound in meetings, by having great relationships with women, by having money, by having toys. I looked for power everywhere else. And it wasn't until I was sober quite a few years that I started looking in the last place deep down within me. And I found God somewhere as a result of clearing away the things in my life that blocked me from Him. There's an old story. I'll tell you this and I'll shut up. I was a couple years sober, and I hadn't worked the steps really as they're outlined in the book yet. But I was getting ready, you know, I'm almost there. And I was working for a man who was trying to redeem me as an employee. Now, my first 4.5 years of sobriety, I went through 9 jobs before I worked the steps. And it's never my fault. I can get a good job working for good people. And then after I'm there for a while, it's like their mask comes off and I realize they're taking advantage of me and it's like they're idiots and they don't do it right. And well, I went through 9 of those. And I get this one employee who's trying to redeem me. So he gives me a set of tapes, not AA tapes. It's a set of motivational tapes by a guy named Earl Nightingale. And Earl Nightingale was a motivational speaker, and the set of tapes was called Lead the Field. And it was supposed to help you to become a less self-centered employee and more like a team player, right? But he doesn't know who he's dealing with. It takes more than a set of tapes for me. I'll tell you. I need God. But I'm listening to these tapes, and there was a story in these tapes that really had a lot of impact on me. And the story, according to Earl, and it was a true story. And he says, what I'm about to tell you, it actually happened back in the 1800s in Africa, South Africa. And the story was about a guy who had inherited a ranch from his father. And it was a nice ranch, not a huge make-you-rich ranch, but the kind of ranch where you could have gotten a nice living for you and your family off of, and maybe your kids would have a nice living off that ranch. And it gave him everything he needed. But he inherited that ranch at a time when the diamond boom was on in South Africa. And he was hearing the stories of people becoming Bill Gates-like mega rich overnight. And the more he heard the stories of their abundance, the more dissatisfied he became with what he had. Sound familiar? And after a while, he just got so fed up and so obsessed with making it rich that he sold his ranch, took the money, and invested it into equipment and went out into the bush in Africa, obsessed with finding diamonds and making it rich. Well, he never did. And after years out in the bush of a hard life, he died bitter and broke and alone. And it came to pass that the ranch he sold to these brothers, and they were developers, and they were clearing some land one day, and they move these rocks aside, and they find these unusual rocks, and they don't know what they are. They're strange looking. They take them down, and they're raw, uncut diamonds. And they discover that this ranch was the largest diamond deposit ever recorded in South Africa. Now, these two guys, they become like two of the richest men in the world almost overnight. And the one guy says to the other one day, he says, well, we have got this big company we're putting together to mine and market and distribute these diamonds around the world. We need to name this company something. And the one brother says, well, let's name it after that poor son of a bitch that we bought this ranch from. And the guy says, yeah, wasn't his name De Beers? And I'm listening to that story, and I'm thinking, I'm that idiot. I'm that guy. I'm looking everywhere else, and God has put it. I sat in 5,000 meetings over the years and listened to this simple statement. And here are the steps we took, which are suggested as a program of recovery. Thanks.